Hello, it's Sarah Pascoe here. Welcome to a second series of Sex, Power, Money. I so enjoyed the response to the first series. I really loved how all of you engaged with the guests and the topics, and just like me, finding out about people's lives. And I also wanted to start this series with an apology, because in the last episode of the first series, I said something very flippantly, which upset some people. And it was actually very interesting for me. It gave me a lot of time for reflection, because having done a series about, well, I guess like exploring people's lives, hearing from people that perhaps we don't hear from every day because they work in the sex industry or stripping or activists for sex workers, I then slipped up right at the end and said something quite derogatory in a jokey way about mothers and housewives or people who choose to stay at home with their children. And when I got messages from women telling me, oh, I was really enjoying your series, and then I felt you said something that was quite spiteful about my life choices, what I realized is that, like all human beings, I have blind spots. And I think I thought I was joking about something. I hadn't even considered that for somebody listening, they would feel it as a nasty or mean thing, that didn't consider their life choices as worthy as other people's. So I do want to fully apologize for what I said. And I also want to say, for those of you that contacted me, and I did try to write back to all of the messages or the comments that I saw, you were absolutely right to pull me up on it. I'm a childless woman, and sometimes I get hard and defensive. And that often causes not only our ignorance about other people's decisions, but it causes us not to empathize properly if we kind of shut off that some people are other than us or different in some way. So I'm truly sorry for those of you I hurt, and I am trying to learn just like everybody else. So thank you for coming back to the second series. We have got some incredible guests lined up, much more men than last series, and lots of different approaches to sex work and stripping and historical sex research. And I think you're going to find it really fascinating. For episode one, I am joined by a man called Jason Domino. He is a sexual health activist, as well as being a sex worker that meets clients, and he performs in the porn industry. He has spoken at the United Nations, representing HIV activism from adult performers and challenging relationships and sex education to do more. In 2016, Jason was attributed as the first person to demonstrate on film the HIV prevention drug PrEP in an educational adult film called Porn for PrEP, which we'll be finding out a lot more about that a bit later on. He also works at a sex worker safety charity called National Ugly Mugs and is the sexual health lead for the UK Porn Union, UK Adult Professionals. Just a note, this series was recorded with people in their own homes, as we are socially distant and aware of the virus. So any background noises that you do hear, engines going past, gardening, my dog occasionally, that's because we're all in our own houses. So I hope you don't find it too distracting.
So my very first porn scene was with someone who was living with HIV. And I didn't really know what to do with that information, because I feel like the information that I was given was kind of what everyone had before that sort of time. However, around 2015, people were starting to independently get access to something called PrEP, which is this pill routine that can prevent HIV transmission if taken before contact and taken like as correctly advised. And so this opportunity to be able to understand, okay, my first porn scene was with someone who was living with HIV, but there was something that I could do in order to prevent like those future sort of exposures, meant that it was a really big like learning curve for me.
That's really huge, yeah. Because I'm sure one of the things that happens, everyone has regular tests in porn, don't they? So in going into a scene, was it a complete surprise to you that you were working with somebody who was living with HIV?
I mean, it's a pretty rare situation where someone will find themselves in this place. I mean, it's something has gone wrong, some paperwork has gone wrong at at some point in the process. So I should have been given a bit of paperwork which asked whether I was comfortable working with someone with a different HIV status. It's a little bit more common in the gay porn scene, where we sort of handled this a little bit differently. So I wasn't given this paperwork. And then I discovered after the scene that my partner had been living with HIV. And again, I had just grown up watching things like the Tombstone adverts. And so was just sort of terrified and thought, you know, I must have contracted HIV because I just had sex with them. I didn't really know that the chances aren't like certain if you've had sex with someone who's living with HIV. And there's also something that I could do. So I went to hospital and I went on PEP as opposed to PrEP. And obviously that means it can prevent you from contracting HIV if started early enough after the exposure.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think probably lots of people are quite ignorant about HIV until they either know somebody who is living with it or they become kind of interested or close enough themselves to do the research. I did a temp job years ago at a clinic on Tottenham Court Road, which specialised in HIV diagnosis, because the fact is that it's obviously an ongoing process. But I remember being so surprised when I started work that we had people who'd been coming for 40 years, as in, because I had thought, oh, well, it's something you die of eventually. But my eventually was actually quite a small amount of time. People got taught these things about kind of, you know, the AIDS crisis, and that's where their learning stopped.
Absolutely.
And so I had no idea that PrEP was a thing until you just told me.
So, really?
No, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So I didn't know that was a thing. I mean, that's huge, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of frustrating that it's not been getting more traction, because I mean, it works very similar to the contraceptive pill. But actually it's for preventing HIV transmission. So people that don't have HIV would go on this course, and it means if they come into contact, they're protected. But it feels like, because it's talking about HIV, there's always been this stigma to be able to properly go into the topics and maybe say only some communities can talk about this. But you're absolutely right. Even the fact that people can now live with HIV for a long, long time and have long, healthy lifespans. I mean, if you look at the lifespan of people living with HIV in France, it's actually longer than people not living with HIV because of the sort of consistency of care.
Well, you have to make very healthy choices, don't you? So quite often with patients, they very rarely, if ever, drank. They never took drugs. They had to take such good care of themselves because they were aware that would have such a huge impact on their lifespan. So it doesn't really surprise me if they're kind of, sometimes actually outliving other people because they're so conscious of their body.
Absolutely. And fitness routines, mental health care, like there's something about that time. And even just having an HIV scare. I mean, I feel like an HIV scare is probably not the correct wording for it, because again, there's something that kind of awakens in you to take your sexual health seriously and your wider healthcare seriously. That's what happened for me. I would say that the time was like one of the, even though it was a very scary moment, it was one of the best things that could have happened to me. Mm. I learned about HIV so much more. I started going on to PrEP as soon as I'd finished my course of PEP, which is that post-exposure care. And I started telling people about PrEP. I mean, I had a number of friends that had contracted HIV, and I realized that I couldn't stay quiet about it. So I then dedicated quite a lot of my time and even my porn work to, I know we can't show this on a podcast, but I even have a tattoo on my chest
says
PrEP on a dog tag.
Yes. Along
with U equals U, decrim, and the HPV vaccination.
HPV vaccination I know about, decrim I know about, and I saw on our Twitter as well, it's decrim with drugs as well as sex work for you.
And HIV disclosure laws.
Okay.
And that sounds quite scary.
No, but particularly, I don't even know, what are the HIV disclosure laws?
Well, it's talking about it all sort of globally, internationally. Mm. A number of different countries and even across different states, when we're just talking America, handle HIV disclosure differently. But if we just take the mindset of us as people who, we hold HIV negative test results, I'm assuming, although it's you can never really know unless it's a personal detail.
Yes. Talking
about us, it's not actually safe for us to overly rely on something like the law to make someone else tell us what their HIV result is. Because most of the time people catch HIV from someone who doesn't know that they have it.
Sure.
So that false sense of security can actually, it needs to be something that we take care of ourselves and place in our own hands. So something like condom use, PrEP, you know, having a partner who is undetectable. So that's a partner who is actually living with HIV, but is taking their medication to the point where the amount of virus in their body is counted to what's known as undetectable. That's what one of the symbols on my tattoo stands for, U equals U. That means someone who's undetectable is untransmittable. So actually having sex with them is a safer, I know it sounds ridiculous, but actually having sex with them is a safer alternative to having sex with someone who has a status, a result which says that they're HIV negative.
Sure,
And that's just because there's still unknowns. The test has a window period, meaning that it can't account for the most recent exposures.
Mm.
So that there's a small amount of period before you've had that test where the results may not reflect. So the NHS standard, I know this is getting all super technical, but HIV test has about a month long window period.
Yes. So that's why they sometimes tell you, if you think you've had an exposure, they'll say, wait a few weeks and then come in, because we can't tell you anything for sure unless we've had that amount of time between.
Precisely. Yeah. That's exactly it. I mean, and there's different HIV tests. So it's always worth chatting to whoever's giving it to you and saying, what type of HIV test is it? How long is the window period? Because there is that time where you may have had an exposure and it may not show in the results.
Yeah. So just to circle back to you, when you say so in terms of like working in pornography, was that in this country?
So it's been a little bit of hopping around. I mean, mainly in this country, but you know, the industry is pretty international. And
well, that's it. So I never think of porn being made in this country. That's why I was asking. I always think of porn as something that happens in California or in kind of Sweden or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, there are parts of the world where the industry is significantly bigger.
Yeah,
but. There's still quite a reasonable industry here, particularly in different parts of the sector. I would say it was a lot bigger prior to 2014, but there were some legal changes which sort of made it a little more challenging to film.
Is that
in the UK.
One? I remember a protest where they sat on people's faces outside Parliament, because one of the things that had been outlawed was women weren't allowed to sit on faces anymore in British porn. Was it then?
Absolutely. What was that? The Audiovisual Regulations Act. Yes, it's now been undone, but it was that protest and to that set of regulations about what was obscene and porn and what wasn't, and it's kind of been undone later on.
Yes, and when did they undo it? Do you remember? Because that was about that bit.
So it was about a year ago. So it was relating to a court case where. Basically, a crowd of individuals deemed that something like fisting porn wasn't actually completely obscene. And like, as an example, that was something that really sort of highlighted just the flaws in the decisions that were made in the 2014 legislation.
Yeah. It's really fascinating.
Yeah.
It must be weird to go to court for it. It must be weird for the activists to go, well, actually, I'm going to go and stand in front of a judge and explain fisting. And show why the state has absolutely no right to come and talk about what I do in the bedroom.
It's exactly the case. I mean, it's very strange to have committees in different places deciding these things and not inviting the professionals it's not even always professionals. People do a lot of these things recreationally. It's very strange to have these decisions made for us. It's been one of these journeys that occasionally steps like this happen, then we kind of unpick them, and it just takes individuals telling truths and saying, okay, well, let's not be afraid to talk about this. And I think the public do a lot better when you're able to have conversations like, you know, getting the HPV vaccination and why you would, and these sorts of things. It just kind of opens up the bedroom a bit.
Yeah. Well, it opens up people's hearts to the bedroom, that everyone who does different stuff to you isn't a kind of a freakish monster. They're just like you.
Exactly. That's exactly it. I mean,
because along with stigma alongside sex, what there is a lot of fear. Quite often, like lack of knowledge makes people terrified of something, and then they get terrified that knowledge will make people, like the reason, like the HPV vaccine or something, the reason someone might not want their daughter to be vaccinated is because they will say, well, I don't want. But they used to be the same with contraceptives. Like, the doctor didn't have to tell a parent if they'd put you on the pill, and parents were absolutely outraged at that because they're like, well, they're all going to go out and have sex with each other all the time.
It's been the same backlash with PrEP, even though we're talking about some really fundamental health benefits and personal choices for so many people.
Yeah.
There's people that react to it and say, oh, well, people are just going to be irresponsible, as if, it's their choice to get involved in someone else's decisions like that. And B, that actually safety measures isn't an act of being more responsible rather than less. It's being sort of realistic with the decisions you need.
I find that so shocking because it feels like the most responsible thing to do in the world. If your life choices or the areas that you're being sexual in make you think I might be vulnerable or at risk, to preempt that and then you keep everyone around you safe. It's almost like the people who don't know wear the masks. I know it's not the same reasoning, but people who go, well, there's a safety measure. Why wouldn't you do it?
Yeah, this is it. I mean, you know, people get afraid of new things. You know, also because these get developed by pharmaceuticals and they don't have a great reputation for many important reasons why. But the nice thing is with things like PrEP, it's been activists. It's been the community that have said, we need to make sure there's access to this. It's economically viable to everyone so that it's not something that's separating certain marginalized communities away from accessing. So it really has been, it's been a real journey.
Who have been the people who've pushed back against PrEP?
So to begin with, it wasn't even getting onto the NHS, which was heartbreaking to see. And then the National AIDS Trust took Public Health England to court and said, why are you not funding this? And the court basically said, it sort of highlighted that some of the reasons why it wasn't being funded were people saying, some of the things that we've said before, there were individuals who said, oh, we don't want people sleeping around and making quite big assumptions, as opposed to considering that it is a tool out of many tools and that people sort of choose what's effective for themselves. If they realize that they're not using condoms, even if they put it in their bag, then they're really being quite sensible. And PrEP won't be for everyone. You know, taking pills isn't something that everyone's comfortable with. And it's just in the same way that contraceptive isn't for everyone either. Contraceptive pill.
Yeah.
So it's just another tool on the table. And I've been on PrEP for about 4 years now. I haven't had a single side effect. And there's many cases where I know I would have contracted HIV had I not been on it.
Yeah. And so it must be for porn workers a particularly important tool, because with porn, as we know, in all different kinds of variety of porn, the condom is very rarely seen, and there's so much pressure on people who make porn not to be using visible contraception. I know it's not contraception
But protection. I know I get what you mean though, because it's a bit of a mixture. I mean, I know it's not contraception, yeah. But it's for example, the American gay porn industry has been quite it's been using condoms a fair amount. The mainstream of porn, there's been using quite a lot of condoms. That's been changing a lot, particularly with things like PrEP being available, but also things like the market has been changing for porn. So you now have like free porn tube sites, which potentially takes our content. Maybe not even it, without our permission, because it could be someone who's ripped it, put it online, and then monetized it. So these studios are competing with all of that to the point where they may be making less welfare focused decisions to try and to stay viable as companies. So that's a difficult situation to be in, really.
It's a huge thing. And also it's something that consumers of porn, which is most... Sorry, it's my dog crying, by the way, not me. Hey, I'll throw your ball. There you go. So it's something that... consumers of porn don't realize that they actually are a big factor in, because if they never pay for the content that they watch, then they are the people who advertisers are paying for their eyes. So the company who's stolen the content has made their money. And if that's a person who has any concern for the welfare rights of porn workers, then they don't realize they're complicit in a system.
Absolutely. I mean, people seem to understand it with something like YouTube. Like if someone stole someone else's content, uploaded it, and then monetized it, they would be like, this is fundamentally wrong. And when it comes to porn, I think because it's, again, it's sex and people are afraid or just don't like talking about sex, even if they're enjoying the benefits of it. It's the same situation there. It's an interesting one though, because if you pay the performer directly, there can be some great benefits for that. At the same time, some of the studios are, for example, accountable to unions and to rules, and they're able to do things with processes. So for example, consent forms before you start filming, or requiring the STI checks, whereas individually people might be a bit more lax. So there's kind of a balance of different things, different advantages and disadvantages.
In John Ronson's series, the last Days of April, little fact check here. I just mispronounced the name of John Ronson's podcast series. It's called The Last Days of August, not April. Almost right. I got John Ronson's name right. It was something that I hadn't realised. Lots of people, it makes them feel a lot better, the consent form signing, and especially in some pornographies, you actually saw it happening, like at the end, but they weren't giving the performers their check until after they'd signed the consent forms, which kind of undermined the whole signing of consent forms. It's like, all you have to do is sign this and then you get your check. It's like, oh, that's so dodgy.
I mean, different studios handle it in different ways, but you're right. It's a tricky one. But a lot of the time, the consent form has to be done at the end, because otherwise, if it was done beforehand and then actually something awful happened on set, well, they've already done this consent form.
Yeah. It's like, oh, they consented to these things and something else happened that absolutely wasn't consented to. And then you're in the same grey area. Yeah.
This is the situation. And I think it's a space why worker unions have been evolving to try and better this situation. But I've got to say that I think in the porn industry, we have a lot to learn from the more generic sex. Generic is such an is probably the wrong word for the situation, but from the wider sex worker rights movement, because their heart has been on the sort of worker rights from very early on. And the porn industry seems to have been distracted by the glamour and the sort of hierarchical structure of things for some time, and only now beginning to understand that being called a worker is a real privilege. Like, labourers' rights is an honour.
Because as a sex worker, all of the different varieties of sex workers, but there's never been fame in it. Like, number one, there's been very little... mainstream crossover, but then there's also never been like, you're so good at sex work that like you're the sex worker that everyone wants. And whereas that does happen with porn, like with porn, you are instantly a star. There's no just like porn actor. It's like, no, porn star. I've been in one porn. I'm the star, isn't there? And so I guess that is it. That there's a hierarchy in porn and a potential for like to be a multi millionaire and a household name, as lots of people. Like porn stars are and have been.
I mean, it's a mix, because also the glamour is part of our marketing. Like most porn sort of performers that I know, they, or porn stars, however they want to be marketed, that they, you know, they're marketing for that glamour and to look wealthy. And that's because consumers feel more comfortable watching their content when they feel that that's part of the brand that they're showing. Whereas in real life, I mean, I know for myself, I make more money seeing a client individually than I do on a porn set. And it's not like I'm getting royalties from people watching the porn scene, unless it's potentially something that I'm selling on one-on-one sort of basis. So there isn't that much money in there, but there can be other benefits. So maybe I get some free content that I can use for marketing, and then maybe people will want to meet with me one-on-one. there's these sort of crossovers where people move from different parts of the industry.
Yeah. And would you say that's quite a common thing to kind of work in both, sort of to see people one-on-one as well as filming things?
I would say it's pretty common. I know for some people's, again, for some people's brand, it's potentially something that's fairly hidden. But we also have to remember, again, with things being international, in some places it's illegal to meet clients one-on-one, but it's, lawful to be doing porn. So a place like that would be like America. Whereas, the type of sex work that I do in the UK is legal, whether it's meeting a client or in porn. For some people, that presents a barrier in itself there, or degrades potentially some of the glamour that they've invested in. The thing is that there's such dignity in the sex worker rights community that it's frustrating that it's presented in that way, and there is somehow seen this hierarchy of jobs over each other.
Yeah. What's interesting from hearing you talk is actually, so part of the allure when people are watching pornography, obviously to masturbate to, something I think they like to imagine is that the people who are performing are really loving what they're doing. And then that can be such an element of some sex workers' experience as well, is that some of their clients really want to believe that they have a connection. They do care about you. I'm the person they really like seeing. It's not like a job with me. So what they're paying for sometimes is quite a lot of a lie. It's like, don't ruin that mystique. Yeah.
Well, this is it though. I mean, if we're talking fantasy and reality, of course, for some people, that's part of what they're paying for is the illusion there. And to some extent, that's all it's ever promised to be. I mean, in the same way that, like, if we're talking specifically about porn, if you hold it to a parallel of like a movie, maybe a horror film or a romantic comedy or whatever, it's presenting something. It's not trying to present reality. It's presenting something for you to dip into for a bit. And whatever the realities are behind that, you're hoping are being taken care of by sort of, performers, rights and correct payment and these sorts of things. But when it comes to individual clients, for myself, when I meet clients, it's a massive variety whether I'm enjoying my work or not. I mean, with any job, sometimes things are a bit rough and it's a bit like, oh, I'm glad that one's over. But sometimes, for example, I'm helping someone discover their sexuality and actually decide, like, maybe that maybe they're married and they have kids and they are terrified of this idea of embracing their sexuality as a gay man. Yeah. And they can only start to dip into, actually, I can be realistic about embracing who I am by a little bit of an experience and start to see this is what's after this potential disaster they see of being open with the family, being open with the people and saying this is who I am. Like a little bit of hope that you could find love and it might feel a bit like this afterwards.
There's so much to lose if it feels like that to them, to even see what's on the other side of that, the things they have to gain, of course, would be a really important ingredient, rather than it being a hypothetical. Something exactly. I thought of when we were talking about the money thing, like in terms of why people don't care that pornographers are making work and it's being stolen. As part of it, I think, is stigma around sex, but also I think there's something with creativity in general. I was reading today, there was this huge row going on Twitter because a musician was annoyed about something happening with COVID. And someone said, if you were a real songwriter, you'd still be writing songs, whether you were paid or not. And then people were like piling on him, go like, what do you think it is? Like, and actually some people do believe, oh, that's true. Like, so if you love sex, you'll just make some porn and it's just there because you love doing it. And yeah, if you're a guitarist, you're just playing the guitar. If someone happens to buy a single, who cares?
Thank you so much for saying this, because again, it's exactly what we see. We see a lot of people who are sort of fighting our rights, saying, if you wanted it that much, then you'd be doing it for free. And it's fundamentally, if we're doing labor, even if it's emotional labor, sexual labor, like, or a combination of all of those components, it still doesn't mean that we think we should be doing it for free. Other people in their jobs don't love them that much that they do it for free.
No, of course not. And also everyone else understands the agreement on two sides, that all of us have to survive, so we all exchange goods and services. That's the deal.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, a lot of my other clients are... a lot of my other clients are either disabled and I've been treated as sort of undesirable by like a large percentage of mainstream culture unfairly. And what I'm giving them, okay, it's a fantasy for a moment, but it's still a normalization and something that they've deserved to have access to. But that doesn't mean that I necessarily would be doing the labor unless I was individually attracted to some of the individuals that I was seeing. That doesn't mean I wouldn't be doing it for free. Mm. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, even though there's something right there, it doesn't mean that it's... So there's some really strange complexes there. Or people that are trapped in their sexuality or trapped from accepting their sexuality because of their faith, and potentially getting into quite extreme, like radicalized positions to try and like compromise against their sexuality. People like... The Pulse nightclub shooter, potentially.
Yeah.
Like I've met some really quite extreme people who are digging down into their faith because they're so ashamed of their sexuality.
We mentioned the Pulse shooting there. That was a gay nightclub in Orlando. In 2016, Omar Mateen, a 29-year-old security guard, killed 49 people and wounded 53 others in a mass shooting there. That was actually the deadliest incident in the history of violence against LGBT people in the United States.
And of course it's right to be able to help people out there, but it's not easy work and you don't just do it for free.
No. Well, people also, sometimes people who find it difficult to understand transactional sex, the one thing they can understand or do think, oh, well, that's very good and moralistic, is when they find out, oh, some people don't have access to any sex or any comfort or any touch from other human beings unless they pay for it. And then they go, okay, well, that's fine then, because that's very good. Oh, I really agree with that. Yeah, and then that's like the... On my first series, I spoke to two sex workers in the first episode, and one of them does, like you, like quite a lot of work with people who... She's the only contact they have, and they wouldn't otherwise have sexual contact with another human being. And people were like, I didn't even know that happened. That's so good. Like, that's really, actually. More people should know.
And I don't want to throw other sex workers under the bus, because it's not just this end of the spectrum which should be given that dignity.
Yeah.
It is frustrating that there is this separation happening, but you're right. It takes people to think about it. It takes people to realize things like, I started sex work because I was taking care of a partner who had quite high depression, and I needed to pay enough money to be able to get them therapy access. They're falling through the gaps in support. Like, and many people were are sort of in that sort of situation. A lot of people are doing it because they're taking care of people they love. You do what you can when there's someone that... And a little bit of backstory can help make people see that actually
humanize it.
It's not this awful thing. Yeah.
I guess that that's what happens is sometimes with what I would call like empathy failure, it's just because a person can't imagine themselves in that situation. But something like that, caring for a partner, they suddenly can imagine themselves. But that's because the sex bit obliterates all of the economics. It's like, oh, stop thinking about sex, think about money. And think about where it comes from and how sometimes you might need some. Okay, here we go. Now we can talk about why you might make a certain decision.
You're absolutely right. And yet, if you said, okay, for caring for your child, like how much would you do in order to take care of your child when they're in trouble, then it becomes a very simple topic for them. You're absolutely right. I mean, real-life scenarios.
Well, the other end of it with people, and for whatever their reasoning, who want to help people exit. When I say want to help, it's because they always have an idea. Some people definitely would want to exit sex work or make money a different way. Or sometimes they don't need your help, in quotation marks. But what they always find is the issue of childcare, because they come in and they go, you can do this and you can do that. And they're like, well, then who's looking after my kids? Because I work for 2 hours, three nights a week. What's going to give me that job flexibility, please, in this exit strategy?
Exactly. Yeah. For so many people, that the sort of push for exiting is just, we don't want to look at it. We don't want to look at it because it's, Well, there's many reasons why people want to sort of simplify the situation, but it rarely does address the core topics of why someone has gotten into sex work.
Mm.
I mean, there's so many reasons.
Well, then this is where we should now talk about decrim, because quite often the reason is because, I mean, awful things do happen. People know the very, very worst. They know that there are people who want to pay someone for sex in order to have someone alone with them who's vulnerable and who they can, you know, physically attack or assault. And I think people who believe, well, that's so terrible. How do we protect people? I know, we'll put everyone in prison. Everyone. Yeah, we'll make everyone a criminal. That will solve the problem.
Gee, thanks.
Yeah, great. Yeah.
That's going to take really good care of my partner or kids or whatever situation.
Yes.
You're absolutely right. I mean, this reaction of like prison and police is going to resolve everything it's just kind of escapism and denial of the topics, rather than actually saying, okay, we'll look into these situations and see where people are falling through the cracks, or what type of support would they need if they wanted to take other pathways. But ultimately, for a lot of people, they only truly consider changing their sex work if they're doing well enough to be able to feel like they are going to take risks in reinvesting in something else and take a, like trying something else. I know for myself, whenever I've been sort of squeezed hardest, whether it's through criminal pressure or all sorts, it just makes me want to do it more secretively and sort of better. I mean, when I first started sex work, I thought I was breaking the law. I didn't realize that actually the type of sex work that I was doing, because there's different distinctions of what's illegal and what's not. I wasn't aware that what I was doing actually wasn't breaking any laws.
Yeah.
So that shows that actually the legal definition didn't make that much difference to me. I was doing it because I wanted to care for my partner.
Yeah. I think that's the other thing, you know, I don't know if we were talking about this earlier. Oh, we were talking about with sort of education about PrEP or something. People think that's going to encourage behaviours. I think one of the arguments, and the very simplistic ones against decriminalisation, is that, well, then we'll all be sex workers. If it's just fine, then we'll all just do it. We'll just do it after, we'll do it at lunch break, make a bit of, like, they think there's going to be this sudden mad rush. Like all school kids will be, you'll go to the job centre and they'll say, hey, here's a job.
You're absolutely right. It's completely farcical. Like, not only is it incredibly hard work that not everyone feels comfortable doing, but again, it's this situation where if you have desire to work in other jobs, why wouldn't you explore those opportunities instead? And some people will potentially be sex working at a difficult time of their life, but maybe get into something that maybe they found fitted and better in another time of their life. It's just, the conversations become so black and white.
Yes.
It's very frustrating.
Yeah. Well, it's because, so my ignorance before, so this is even like 2 years ago, before I'd ever spoken to a sex worker, my ignorance was that everything I'd read about sex work or ever even absorbed was either a very, very broad strokes Disney-fied version, you mean like Pretty Woman or Secret Diary of a Call Girl, or... it was from feminism. And so, and no, obviously I am a feminist of a type. Some would say I'm not, but I am a feminist. And so it meant that everything that was about, you know, like protection and vulnerability and exploitation, and I had just taken all of that as facts. And I had never heard from someone whose job it was. I'd never heard their side.
This is it. It's so frustrating that so many of these proposals are put forward as just a blanket of feminism, and even as a male sex worker, just existing quite often doesn't fit into some of that narrative, because it's often painted as vulnerability ignored to women and girls.
Yes, exactly. And also because the male body is the violent, the potential for violence, and the male is the aggressor, and so there isn't any way, because that stops it being a binary argument. The minute you go, well, what about the I saw that there was a feminist article on your Twitter that you'd retweeted. I won't name who it is because I don't want to bring her wrath on either of us. have you ever had to debate a feminist or anything? Have you ever?
Oh, all the time.
Oh, have you? Okay.
You know, we tend to call the feminists that we're having those debates with, we call them sex worker exclusionary radical feminists, because often there's an agenda of of taking this ideology of, if sex work didn't exist for a moment, just hypothetically, if somehow it was something which could be made impossible and didn't exist, then just think of how much easier fighting sexism would be. Like, and it goes down this fairy tale as if one that's achievable, as a real pathway, and that it would be achievable through punishment and punitive action towards people that have taken that pathway. But two, that like doing that is something that would sustain like an actual sexism, would sustain something that's fighting sexism, where someone couldn't be whoever they were as a woman and still be honored, respected, and given the platform for however she lived. If you're cutting out certain types of women and saying that this person is the person that we can respect, and so much of that is fundamentally unfeminist. Like it, and I know I'm a man saying this, so it's incredible. There's this real sort of dichotomy which I had to present here, but it's this. They're treating us as experiments, us as in the wider sex worker community, as experimental group of people that could be sacrificed for this strange, again, social experiment of whether it'll be easier to fight sexism once we're gone.
They profess to want to help women to equality or to a better state of equality, and then blame some women as the not in any way as reflections of their culture or active beings making decisions, but as actually against the whole cause. You taking your top off over there and posing means you're teaching all of these straight men that they are allowed to objectify you as a thing. And then that schoolgirl is getting shouted at on the way home in her school uniform. And they're like, it's your fault. Like, you are teaching men that, isn't it? I mean, it is. It's a...
No, that's exactly how it's presented. Yeah.
It's such a flawed argument, the idea that if you take something away, everything else will then... Now we can heal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Exactly. And even the terms of objectification, which is one of these classics that get fired at us, it seems to be so divorced from the original sort of terminology of what it even meant. I mean, as an individual, there are times where there's part of our physical being that can just want to be like appreciated for that, and that doesn't necessarily meaning that we're endorsing a wider non-fantasy version of like objectification. It doesn't mean that we're while embracing certain narratives that we're saying that that's okay as a societal treatment of certain groups of people.
For instance, someone might send someone a picture of their genitals and they're not saying... So someone sends someone a dick pic, they're not going, hey, I'm a thing, don't ever empathise with me. They're playing with something as part of a bigger fantasy. They're not going, hey, I've got no human rights, I'm a two-dimensional photograph.
Mm.
Is that right or no? I'm trying to fact check here, but all I can tell you is that's a bad analogy. I was using a bad analogy.
There's such a mixture going on there, because there is so much of this sort of power play which is being used, as opposed to like necessarily just trying to stimulate someone.
Can probably help me with this, because one of the podcasts I already did was with Kate Lister, who has written a big history of sex. Oh, and if you'd like to find out more about Dr. Kate Lister, she'll be coming up in episode 2. She said that because she runs a Twitter page, which is called Whores of Yore, and she does lots of sexual facts from all different cultures throughout history, she gets sent a lot of dick pics and no one ever tells you why. Because I was saying, I don't think it's because you're supposed to enjoy them. I don't think if they send them to a stranger, that's supposed to be nice.
Yeah, it's a very strange one. I mean, I get a lot as well, but...
Sure.
I don't know. I think in the gay community,
and do they feel aggressive? Sometimes do they feel aggressive when you get them?
There's certainly plenty of times when they're unpleasant.
Mm.
I'd say I can understand the aggressive component, particularly if it's on a platform like Grindr. Sometimes it feels like someone's unhappy that they're being rejected on multiple accounts. And their reaction is just be like, I'm going to send this at you type thing.
Mm.
It's, at the same time, our community hasn't come from a space where, like, showing the body has been, as a gay community, no, our background is this whole thing of it was illegal to be gay. People were meeting in cruising grounds, meeting in the woods and in toilets in order to sort of secretly meet one another. And our history is things like showing each other dicks at the urinal. And it's, okay. I mean, you can think of that as massive disgust, but our history hasn't come from a place where, like, marriage, childcare has been the fundamentals where relationships have grown. It's grown from sexual need, like showing what's been happening and kind of taking it from there. So I think it feels slightly less aggressive because it's also just a bit more, there's this practical element where plenty of people that are in the closet are just tapping into a sexual component of their life and they're tapping out again.
Yeah.
And it kind of relates a little bit to that.
That's so interesting because that's an angle I've never thought of or even considered, that of course, in like a needs must, there was a matter of factness that was part of a gay man's experience, or yeah, a gay man who wasn't ever able to express that sexuality in the rest of his life. It makes me, it must make you so sad, because you always hope as society improves that people will be able to kind of explore their sexuality through adolescence and then be comfortable however they want to present or whoever they want to have sex with. And the fact that now there are still people who are going to have to go through such painful transitions to have a happier life.
Absolutely. So, So I went through operant conditioning when I was... Well, I wasn't that young, but I was still involved with the church.
Yes.
And I don't want to be too aggressive towards the church because there are some fantastic churches that sort of celebrate.
Well, they can be great communities for people, can't they? They can offer something.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that tends to be the type of work that I do with my clients who are, when they're feeling oppressed religiously, I kind of point them in the direction of like rainbow mosques or inclusive churches and these sorts of things. It can really help to show there is space to interpret certain sections of faith texts in slightly different ways and it not to be fundamentally radical. It just some simple interpretations of exactly the same text. It's a difficult time. I mean, if people going through something like conversion therapy, which can kind of stem from as little as people sort of praying for you to change to up to sort of as intense a thing as I went through, which was kind of looking at male imagery and drinking liquids that would make me wretch,
nauseous,
to try and build up like an association.
So that's aversion therapy. So the theory is that you start to associate the negative feelings with the imagery, which then means it will drown out any kind of positive feelings or arousal. Whose
Absolutely.
Idea was that?
It doesn't work.
No.
So I think it goes back to, just in case there's any listener, do take my word. Many,
it's just
like
a horrible,
long time
horrible
of trying
thing
this.
That doesn't work. Well, of course, it doesn't work because it wouldn't work with a straight person. You would just make me feel sick.
I'm a gay porn actor, so that's pretty good, pretty good evidence of it not working.
But it wouldn't. It would make you. Of course, you might still absorb like negativity, but it wouldn't work as a switch off as something as deeply wired as sexuality.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there are in psychology there, you know, people like Stanley Milgram and stuff that I think did.
Mm.
That's authority. I'm mixing some of my psychology.
Oh, yes, so Stanley Milgram, he did all of the electric shocks, and it's obedience.
Oh, fun stuff, yeah.
Yeah,
I think it's because they've done a bit of both.
Yes, he was proving, his main thing was to prove that Germans weren't more awful a race than anyone else, that anyone will press a button killing someone if you tell them to in a white coat. That was his experiment.
Oh, my goodness, okay.
But you're right, it's all part of that same behaviourism, understanding humans as like, meet robots doing certain things, and that's what they thought with aversion therapy. I think it's really good for things like, not necessarily aversion therapy, if you've got a fear of spiders, they can do experiments where you associate nice things with spiders and that will eventually lessen your phobia. But what a horrible thing for you to have been through. I mean, I'm really sorry that your religion the church does those kind of things.
I mean, so much
people.
Of it comes back to care. I mean, I pushed myself into it very hard as well. And that was because I cared about my parents' opinion and the community around me's opinion. And if I had had a faith space that showed that they would care about people, regardless if they're gay, then people wouldn't go as far into this. They wouldn't even push themselves as far. Even if they even made versions of this sort of behavior themselves, they wouldn't push themselves into this much damage as a way of saying, I will go this far. And only if this doesn't work, then I'll become gay. Actually, there's long-term damage that happens from doing this sort of this sort of disregard to yourself. I'm really glad that the government is looking into cracking down on the legality of all of this and trying to make conversion therapy completely illegal.
Well, actually, I was reading this week. There's a contrarian on Twitter, and his book, his first opening chapter, I bought his books. I thought sometimes it's really good, you know, because they go, stop trying to shut people down. It's free speech. And you think, oh, maybe I am that. And I started reading his book, and the first chapter is about, and he's a gay guy. But he goes to watch a film, which is advertising conversion therapy as successful. And his, and there's people protesting outside. And his actual point is, there's no point protesting it. It doesn't work. No one, it's not convincing. Society as a whole doesn't need to worry about this anymore. But the people who are arguing with him are saying, there are people who are so vulnerable to this. You aren't anymore. You're a grown adult intellectual man. But there are children growing up in certain families. There are adolescents who, this is their first experience of homosexuality, is this side of it, not all of the rest. But people see it as a free speech issue, don't they?
Absolutely. It's so funny because the conversation can so often just be around some of the most visible parts of the community rather than saying, okay, well, let's talk about people that are deeply in the closet, which is realistically who we're kind of talking about. As you say, like teenagers. I mean, even if you are talking about some of these behavior change ideas in things like AS psychology, like there's the potential for someone who just dislikes their own faith to sort of take these further. I mean, we haven't got to the point where these sort of nuanced real stories are being looked at. It's only something as radical. And I mean, I think part of that is in some ways down to us as a gay community for the fact that so much of our community is protected when we're as loud as we can be. Because if people hate the loudest person, they're more likely to be gentle to the less loud person anyway. But it means reactions like this scenario can sometimes just be fired at the most visually loud representation of what it means to be a gay person.
Right, okay.
I know I kind of worded that in convoluted ways, but it's
but talking about that and talking about sex work and pornography, that everything is so connected to activism. I think one of the privileges of being a straight white person who maybe works in an office is that you don't have to be politicized about anything unless you particularly want to be, because your life isn't affected by other people's morality. Some of your behaviours aren't criminalised. Like you don't have to, and it feels like there isn't that luxury for people like you. You can't just go like,
But you're absolutely right. It's not only it's everything coming back to activism, but the activism so frequently interconnects again. So, for example, if we're looking at PrEP activism and we're saying, okay, well, how do we make sure that everyone has access to this? You find that, okay, well, let's look at brothel workers. Let's look at potentially sex workers working in a brothel, and maybe they have a language barrier. They're relying on their boss to potentially tell them information. Are they going to be getting good access to PrEP, or are they worried about police doing a raid, maybe being deported? Are they getting good information from the boss, or is that boss incentivized to give them some simple information because they're only going to be there for a short amount of time? If they get pregnant or if they contract an STI, it doesn't really impact them. So all of this comes back down to things like, even in PrEP activism, is decriminalization a fundamental component? Like, they're all interconnected. I mean, whether it's drug decriminalization, whether it's HIV laws, whether it's sex work, if you're going to be taking care of health, You have to be fundamental with all of this and say that intersectionality is the only way that you resolve these issues.
Yeah. And actually, so not even in terms of brothel workers, something that I saw when I worked at this clinic was that people who couldn't speak English, women who couldn't speak English as a first language, were completely at the wherewithal of their husbands. Because quite often, if the husband had given the wife an STD and didn't want her to know it was an STD, he would bring her to our clinic and he would deny her a translator. And so then you had doctors in a really difficult position of having to treat somebody without being able to, and they would just, and the husband would say, no, you just give her the medicine, we go home. That exact, people are so vulnerable if someone else is there, I mean, in a position of power over their health.
You're absolutely right. And it's so tragic, it's heartbreaking. Thankfully, some of those issues, things like PrEP, if some of the women in those situations are aware, or some of the spouses in that situation, if they're aware of something like PrEP, then they're maybe less reliant on a partner to use condoms or consent for using condoms, if that's how they
or
feel.
Or even to be faithful, because I guess some of it's infidelity in relationships is where people might go, well, they've promised they're not sleeping with anybody else, but I want to protect myself just in case. And we're trying for a baby, so there's no contraception or something like that. Yeah. And so did you say that it is provided on the NHS now?
So it's been provided currently on what's known as the IMPACT trial. So that isn't like a medical trial. That's just like trialing about how much the costs are for providing it to the public.
Yeah.
That's drawing to a close, and we're going to be looking at a rollout in the next couple of months. So it's going to be worth keeping your eyes peeled for that, because that should be, that basically marks the time where England will join Scotland and Wales in making PrEP fully available for people that are wanting to access it. So that's the next step.
Because presumably the reason it's a costing thing is how much money they'll save by providing this and a certain amount of people then being prevented from catching HIV.
Absolutely. It costs so much more to be treating someone living with HIV and potential co-infections. Not for anyone to sort of, I don't want that to impact sort of stigma towards people living with HIV, but of course there is, the way to be looking at PrEP isn't that, oh, it's an expensive drug. It is that for a number of different capacities, it does save the NHS money, which is why this trial has sort of been done. And to understand what type of clinical procedures are needed to be able to make it available. But I think some of that is a slight assumption that everyone's just going to jump on it because it sounds like a wonder drug.
Yeah.
Whereas different tools are for different people, and you're never going to have everyone saying that that is the one for me.
Yeah.
There's individuals that are just going to pick what works for them, and we need to trust them with that autonomy.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. I'm so glad I've learned more about it. And I was wondering, in terms of our listeners, what I'm going to do is put some links in the show notes for people to go out and find more. So obviously I'll put a link to your Twitter. You're at Jason Domino. That's your suitable for work account. And and in terms of are there any other resources that you think people should go to if this is all brand new information for them? Porn for Prep is the website. Oh yeah. Oh, decrimnow.org.uk. Yes, if you're hearing for the first time words about decriminalising and why it makes sex workers actually safer, which might for you feel like, but what? How are they safer? It's really good to go and read up some more. So go to decrimnow.org.uk. Brilliant. Jason, Fantastic. Thank you so much for talking to me. I hope you have a brilliant afternoon.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for coming.
Have a good afternoon too.
Thank you so much to Jason Domino. I learned so much, I'm sure you have as well. And if you want to continue with your education, Jason has sent me a list of resources and places where you could go and have a look and learn a bit more. I'm also going to put all of the links to these websites in the show notes. But what he's recommended are a really good resource on decrim is decrimnow.org.uk if you want to learn more about that. He mentioned the site for porn activism that he does, and that's porn, P-O-R-N, if you don't know how to spell porn, four, prep.com. Now, just to let you know, there's no actual porn on that site. but it does provide links to explicit or non-explicit versions of a film, but it checks if you're 18 first. The sex worker charity that he works for is called uglymugs.org, and you can find out more about their incredible activism. The porn union is ukap.info, so that's ukap.info. If you wanted to find out about PrEP specifically for women, the resource you need to go to is womenandprep.org.uk. And then if you wanted to find out more about the You Equals You campaign, which was something I knew absolutely nothing about, this is a very complicated website, i-base.info/you, the letter rather than the word, -equals-you. Good luck if you got that from me. Better look in the show notes, because that one's very complicated. Also, it was incredible to hear Jason talking about the conversion therapy that he went through. If anyone is dealing with that, he suggests contacting switchboard.lgbt. So that might be a useful place for you to go. And if any of you would like to donate to support sex workers during COVID-19, because obviously it's affected their industry completely because they can't be in the same place as people, swarmcollective.org/donate is the place. They are doing all of the financial support. So if you do, I know everyone's having a very difficult financial time, but if you can manage to donate, it's the Swarm Collective you need to go to. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much to Jason Domino. This series has got off to an incredible start. I'll be back in 7 days, where I'll be talking to a sex historian. I'll be joined by Dr. Kate Lister. See you then. Through my ears. That doesn't work.